No, I'm really worried for like, I'm worried for India in terms of like whatever's happening with the BJP and all of that. And I don't know, it just feels like I've never felt in my life that, oh my God, I have to like, what if when I go back to India that I have to deal with that? I've never felt that. Straight away from Singapore, I went back to India to work. I had no intentions of staying there, whatever. Just wanted to be back home, work there, live there. But now with all of the things happening, I feel like it's so odd that you kind of have to think twice about going back home.
It's honestly, it's depressive. I'm scared for my family, for my parents, and I mean, just with COVID also, and how things have really escalated in the past couple of weeks, and what's happening with the government or just the authority, that nobody is really working for the people. Everybody has their own agendas, and at the end of the day, a population such as ours, like the size of India, is suffering, is waiting for somebody to help. And I guess it's then that we kind of mobilize as citizens and do something. Like, throughout my social media, there are people, I mean, me and my friends also just trying to amplify, okay, share these posts, do this, do that, help whoever you can. So many people I know have got COVID, got affected by it, are struggling to like figure out or even get like test appointments. That's also now becoming an issue, because just this morning I heard that there's like not enough staff. People who come to take your tests. So it's all quite like crumbling right before your eyes, and then you don't know what to do. Like, I just have to keep telling my parents every day, don't get out of the house, stay home, don't call anybody over. And that's all I can do. And I think that's when it pinches me the most, that I'm so far away that I can only like communicate my worries, but I can't actually do anything about it sitting here. So yeah, it's really upsetting.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, yeah, I mean, we could talk for hours about but yeah, my dad just and even like even the private organizations, like in Bombay, my dad had to still go to office, and he got COVID because of that. And yeah, he's recovered. He's fine. His symptoms weren't like bad, like thank God. But you know, but now with the whatever this new fucking strain again, it's like nothing's gonna work again. What are we doing? Like, how long are we gonna be in this position?
And now with like the summer approaching, and everybody who hasn't seen their families for like a whole year, I don't think they can travel even now, or if it's wise to travel back to India. Like, I'm supposed to go back to India in the summer, but I'm just like, we'll see whether or not I can actually travel. Should I travel back? So all of those questions.
Yeah. Did you get vaccinated yet?
I got the first dose of the Moderna. I'm gonna get the second one in May, like in the first week of May is my second.
Right.
What about you?
Okay. I haven't. Dates have opened up in California. I'm trying to find schedule an appointment with CVS, but everything seems to be like full across the state, so I don't know.
That way, I think Providence was quite proactive in getting, like having people register for the vaccine. And I think initially there may have been like a particular age group that they were catering to, but then they've now opened it up for everybody above 18.
Yeah.
So that's pretty good. And it was a very organized system, lots of volunteers, and it was very smooth, so I'm glad.
Okay, anyway, let's start. We have welcome to Not Enough Design. We have Vrinda Mathur today. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
Of course, you have a you're an industrial designer, furniture designer, multidisciplinary, IDMID, RISD, NIFT, lifestyle products, accessories.
Yes, that's kind of me. Yeah,
that's awesome. I like and obviously co-founder Studio Wood, of course.
That's right.
That's huge. Yeah, so we were talking about you growing up in Delhi, and Delhi is a beautiful city. And so Studio Wood's also founded in Delhi.
That's right. That's right.
So that story you told me a year ago, maybe, about finding Studio Wood, I think it was a really interesting story because it was a unique opportunity for you at that time. I think you guys utilized most of those opportunities to do this, and it's a great story. And maybe get into it a little bit.
Okay. So this is kind of one of my favorite stories and something that makes me very happy. Right out of NIFT, where I studied accessory design in Delhi, one of my closest friends, Navya, and my then boyfriend, now husband, Sahej, co-founded Studio Wood. And it was literally kind of this summer project. We had other friends, my friend Ghazal, who's also a graphic and textile designer. So the four of us kind of got together one summer, and we were kind of fresh out of college, or probably fresh out of our first jobs, because none of us stuck around with our first jobs for some reason. So we were these 22 or 23 year olds wanting to do something. And my parents ran a furniture manufacturing business where they would work with architects and designers on larger hospitality projects and just manufacturing handcrafted furniture. So which meant that I had the opportunity to kind of work with artisans or engage with artisans pretty much like while growing up.
Did your parents do that while you were growing up, so that you saw your parents work with like furniture and objects while you were like,
yep.
Do you think that kind of influenced your path to becoming a designer?
I'm pretty sure, because both my parents are not trained in design. They were more on like the manufacturing side of things, mm-hmm. and just like the business side of things. And something my mom actually started off again as a hobby. Like, she started with cane furniture, and then slowly she got in touch with interior designers and architects and kind of built a little workshop, which was literally our like the back room of our house. That's where she had her little workshop. And this was in 1999, and things kind of grew a little bit from there. They're still like a small business. It's not like they have this massive factory and things like that. So yeah. And every time we would kind of have to go somewhere, like I remember as a kid, my mom would always want to like take a stop at her sites and be like, oh, I have to go check something. And as a kid, I used to get so annoyed, like, why can't we just go? Why do we have to go? Why do we have to stop at your workplace? But I get it now. Like I did it. I've done it myself. So I understand how attached you are to something that you founded or you've created. So I am pretty sure that that influenced my decision in some way. And as a kid, I was always like doing my art and drawings, and like I would even like paint the walls in my room. So I was never, my family was always at the forefront of like pitching my creative side. So yeah, I mean, even though we're digressing a bit from the how we founded Studio Wood story, but I think it's important to highlight what may have sowed the seed for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, should I continue?
Yeah, get back. I mean, yeah, we'll keep on going into tangents, so don't let that distract you. But then the main story is Studio Wood, but then we'll just like, you know, stop.
Yes.
Yeah.
So yeah, coming back to Studio Wood, like I said, we were these 23-year-olds wanted to do something. And because we had access to the infrastructure and the raw material, we kind of set to design some furniture with old salvaged pieces. So mm-hmm. instead of designing things brand new, we came up with the idea of just doing a re-love collection where all of the discarded samples or things that didn't make it to the final site or whatever were taken by us and then redesigned, deconstructed in their form and function. So we did these really fun lights out of chair legs, and we did coffee tables with shelves and things like that. So not just changing the polish or the color and the finish and giving you a new product, but actually thinking about that product in a different light, what else it could do apart from being what it already was. And it was the kind of project where there was no client we were reporting to. It was literally these kids wanting to do something fun. And that's what kind of led to Studio Wood. In our first, the Relove collection, we had about 25 odd pieces, and we curated an exhibit and sale in Delhi again, and completely through social media. So Instagram was fairly new, I think. I'm talking 2014. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just like doing some campaigns and connecting with our friends and like seniors from NIFT, our professors from NIFT, who kind of gave us a push. And we did the first exhibit and pretty much broke even in the first exhibit in terms of our sales. And even though we had access to infrastructure and materials, I think all four of us contributed a little bit from our like savings and did everything else. So there was no like funding or no family funding or no loans or no VC at that time. It was pretty mm-hmm. much like we bootstrapped and kind of put together this whole show. And from then on, I guess Studio Wood was no longer a summer project. It just kind of became a business overnight, something we were not expecting, or we didn't know that this is what was going to happen. But the weekday or the Monday after we finished our exhibit, we all sat together and we said, oh, we have to do these follow-up emails and calls. So, okay, let's see how this, mm-hmm. this stuff is done. And yeah, here we are 7 years later, still doing it.
It's awesome. No, it's commendable that it's almost, you're almost like three years shy of a decade. So like I have two questions for you. What was the job though right before you started Studio Wood?
In NIFT, I guess in the final year, everybody has this graduation project. So it's a 6-month project. And I was at the time working with Swarovski doing lighting design with them. Mm-hmm. And after I graduated, I basically continued my project with Swarovski. So it was more like a freelance come like project based thing. So when that project was closing, I didn't then further go and apply for a job. I just started to pivot myself towards my parents' workshop and started visiting them. And that's kind of what
the Swarovski thing next. Was in Delhi as well.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know Delhi had a Swarovski. Like they have a design studio or like a manufacturing yes. thing.
Yeah, in Gurgaon, actually, in Cyber City, that's where the Swarovski office is. Mm. So, and it was, even Swarovski was a very different experience for me because I hadn't, throughout my projects at NIFT, I felt like I was always more inclined towards furniture and the craft sector more. But then there was this opportunity at Swarovski. I was like, okay, we'll give it a shot. And that came through. And it was kind of my first time working in the luxury design space. But it was a great experience. I made some interesting projects that I wouldn't have otherwise. So yeah.
What was your role at Swarovski?
I was actually working as a designer. So I was in the design team doing a large scale crystal installations. Mm-hmm. But not the typical chandelier. So my grad project at NIFT was actually called Deconstructing the Chandelier. So I was looking at what are the other ways to use crystals, but not in that typical way with the candelabras and things like that. What can I do differently? And And so I was exploring a lot of forms. That's when I also started, I mean, basically when you're working with Swarovski crystals and lighting, the whole idea is how the light falls on the crystals, and that's what kind of makes that installation beautiful and, you know, gives that feel like that grandeur to a space. So just learning what crystals, what colors, how do they work, how do you install it, what kind of lighting to use, and just also how the structure is done, how do you create those massive installations. So that, I mean, it was a great learning for me at the time. And I was also kind of exposed a little bit to the client end at that age, pricing. So it was a good mix, actually.
I remember Swarovski is amazing. Like, all of their stuff looks like, a lot of their installation looks like it's like sculpture. And it's crystal, it's shiny, it's beautiful. But I remember visiting the Swarovski headquarters in Austria.
Right.
They have a beautiful headquarter and they give out these. They don't give it. I think we had to buy it, but I still have them. They have these pencils with the little crystal on the top. That's like their signature kind of thing.
Yeah.
But Swarovski, go ahead.
The crystal duck, is it? Or just the crystal?
No, it's just like a piece of crystal. Yeah, but they do this Christmas tree every year, and they release like a snowflake, which is like an annual drop. So every year it's a different snowflake, and then I think they put the snowflakes around the tree, and there's one special one on top, and then people can go buy the. They're very good at business. Swarovski is amazing. They're everywhere. Yeah.
Like people would request like the size and the scale. I was just like, oh my God, where are you going to put this thing?
Yeah. But
it was fun.
Like growing up, you know, this advice has been given to me a lot, but I really don't think, maybe in some cases it holds true. But in most cases, I don't see why not. They say you should never get into business with your friends or like work with your friends or whatever. You might have heard it too, right? Yeah. But I got into business with my friends, like, and so did you. Do you think that is like a bogus thing to say? Or
I think so, because from the very beginning, I guess all of us established that we are friends first and those relationships are important to us. This is something we've created. I mean, that relationship is important to us, and this is something we've created, and this is a business. So we always kind of hung out together, whether it was in, you know, in college or whether it was just being out and about. But I guess having the conversation in time, if you ever feel like, and again, we were young and stupid. So if there was a fight, you would just be like, not talk for a couple of hours and then come get back to business and be like, okay, I'm sorry. And it's important to do that. It's important to acknowledge that you can be stupid when you're young. So just establish that for yourselves. And that, and I guess just being honest, whether it means that you're feeling like the other person hasn't contributed as much, or the little things that can happen initially when you're just kind of starting off. So I guess just being open about things is important, and that makes the process easier.
Yeah, I totally agree. Because like a lot of the times the move is to like have a fight and then cancel each other, then move away, like never reconciliate, never talk about it. But I think it's important to like have differing opinions and still be able to like be friends, because you know, that's
sure.
Yeah.
And in partnerships that are kind of born out of friendships, it's important to give everybody their space, because when different creatives are working together, you won't always agree. I might like something and the other person might not. And then you come to a consensus for what's better in the larger scheme. And that's happened a lot of times. And it's also that, I think it's also in the initial couple of years that you're still one, figuring out what this company means to you. What are you envisioning for it to be? And you're slowly kind of aligning your goals. So it's also important to set goals. I guess maybe, I mean, if anybody who listens to this podcast is looking to start something new, then I think it's just important to understand that you're starting a business, and there are certain things that will help you work better. Certain rules you want to set for yourself, certain goals. What are your aspirations? Where do you see this going?
So you guys went from like design loving students and people who started a summer project into like a full blown, you kind of like found yourself in a full blown business. Like you found, yeah, you fell into it, right? So when the honeymoon period got over of like, yay, we're doing this, this is fun. And then when it became like a business and it became a day to day thing, do you think it was like a difficult move to like step over?
Yeah, I mean, none of us were from a background in business or marketing and things like that. We were out and out like artists and designers. And I guess that transition was unexpected. And there were little things that happened with time, and which also happen now, but now we're just better equipped to deal with them. So even like facing like the client end and what the client is expecting, what do you bring to the table? And just when it came to like deciding your fee structures, and you're just like, I'm so new, I don't know how to charge. So all of those things are something that you kind of slowly learn and understand, and just how to interact with people, how much, and this came much later, but how you are not available or you should not be available 7 days a week. And just telling yourself that.
Yeah.
Initially, we would be working like late hours in the studio and just finishing something or the other because, oh, we've told the client that we're going to send it to them the other day, but the next day. But slowly, I guess this happened in the third or fourth year, that we will fix a time. If there is something that's urgently has to go out, we will work on it. But we also have to like make time for everything else. In our lives. So we started this rule of like anytime between 9 a.m. to 7 a.m., all our emails will go out, all our interactions will happen, but no emails will go out of the office after 7 p.m. And I think it's important to set that for yourself. And that does not say that we won't work if we had to. We would still do the work, but we don't have to show the client that we're doing the work at 12 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. So that's right.
I absolutely agree. Like, it's important to set that deadline. And I think especially when you're working a business or you're doing something you love, you know, I think I said that in another episode, but when you're the sad part about doing something you love is that you always want to keep doing it, but then it still works, so it takes a toll on you as well. So it's important to set those like boundaries. And I think a lot of businesses don't do that, and it doesn't impact the co-founders because it's their business. So the more work they put in is technically like kind of better, arguably, but it really takes a toll once you start hiring employees. And they kind of look up to the co-founders to define the work culture. And if the work culture is like that, like especially the client is king or the client is queen mindset, it really like hampers. Yeah, yeah. You don't do that?
I don't believe client is king or queen. I think everybody is equal in a business. You've hired somebody for their talent, for their service, and you've hired them because you know they can do the job. So you just have to let them do the job. And it's important to have those boundaries set. And of course, still have, you can have a great working relationship with your clients because the client understands and setting expectations.
Do you have like client horror stories?
Oh, yeah. Don't we all?
Yeah, we do. What's the worst one? Without naming them.
Just like frantic calls and just oh, this hasn't happened, or that vendor did this, now you have to figure it out because you got that vendor on board. Like, also, like, the design industry is so mismanaged in India.
Yeah.
They don't, there's a very thin line between, oh, am I a designer? Am I a contractor? Am I making things? Am I, what all am I doing? What does the client think I'm doing? So again, like I said, setting those expectations.
Yeah.
And trying to have a clear cut contract, even though, I mean, you make a contract, everybody signs it, but nobody really adheres.
That's a good thing to get into. Like, the balance between contracting or giving out the designs and having them manufactured, and that is something that you guys were doing at Studio Wood, right? You guys weren't in the workshops making the pieces yourselves.
No.
Yeah.
So we at Studio Wood did two things. One was complete interior design, where we would design, conceptualize, do all the technicals, get all the materials in place for a space. And then there would be a contractor who would execute that site. We would, of course, be involved in all the decision making. We would do site visits to ensure things are going as per plan. So that's one. With the furniture design also, there were, again, sort of two subsets to it. One are the retail collections that we design. And then one is any kind of custom furniture we design, which means that we've got a client brief and we're designing something specifically for them. And yes, we don't make the furniture ourselves. Like I said, we work in partnership with the craftsmen who are actually doing the physical making. But that said, I don't think it's possible without constant conversation and collaboration. So we would always take our drawings, sit with the carpentry team, understand their perspective, figure out, okay, what's working, what's not working. Because again, I mean, you can make the fanciest of furniture on paper, but how is that going to get executed? So that relationship is very important to us because we're not makers ourselves. We're not trained to make furniture. And I guess that's also an interesting space for creating better pieces. I mean, maybe it's a little technique, maybe it's a little piece of hardware. So constantly, like, being at the workshop, having conversations, ensuring things are getting made the way you want to, and even vice versa. I mean, if I wanted to explore a new technique, which the karigar may not have done before, so it's also what you're each adding to, you know, the piece, which is important.
Yeah. And, you know, and the carpenters, or we call them karigars or masters, you know, they also have so much experience. Like, they've been probably, it's like their family had a carpentry business, and they've been doing it since they were kids. And maybe they have this like mark that they can add to it. They can add to the, it's, yeah, I believe that it's a collaboration, and it's kind of different from how we are trained in design school over here in the US. Yeah. It's in the US, it's very like, you make it and and then we'll think about manufacturing later. Unless you take a manufacturing class, we're never really taught about manufacturing, which is like a collaborative process. And it's interesting, now that I'm in UX design, the collaboration that you have with your design team and your karigar is also what I have between like me and the developer. Like, I can't design a site that can't be developed. And I really like have a lot of respect for developers. And I don't understand, well, like right now the move is to like make things that float on the website, some 3D stuff, pretty designs. And I can only imagine like what a tough time the developers might be having. So, but it's like, yeah, it should be more collaborative and there should be like a dialogue and workshopping. Yeah. But do you think that, so now you have this experience that I don't, like, you've been in design for both your bachelor's and master's, which I haven't. So, but then you've done your bachelor's in India and your master's here. So like, what do you think is the difference between design schools?
To be honest, there's a big difference. I mean, NIFT is supposed to be one of the most prestigious design schools, and then there's NID, and now slowly schools like Pearl and Srishti also coming up. But I still think it's very difficult to really teach design. It has to be a good mix of both research and like your practical solutions, and again, a balance between what looks good and what works well. And to teach that, there, I guess what we maybe missed out was on doing more things ourselves at NIFT. Even though we had the infrastructure, but it was limited. And one of the great things at NIFT we were exposed to was, again, doing a collaboration with artisans. So we used to visit these craft clusters and then learn with the artisans or do research projects. And I think that was one of the biggest highlights for me. But I still feel like we at NIFT, we didn't get that kind of exposure that I'm getting with RISD. Also just the diversity of people, their backgrounds, the kind of professors we have here, or the kind of guest lecturers that come, or just the student body also. And that's what kind of also attracted me, or was one of the sort of defining factors for me to be here. And I have on and off kind of been teaching at NIFT also. And I try to, whenever I'm taking a module, I try to be there and get them out of the classroom. Let's go sit outside. Let's talk about design. And not just like, you can't read and write, and you know, you can't sort of do no design by any kind of rote learning. You need to do it. You need to talk to people. It's a very, it's actually, design is a very, what's the word? You have to have a conversation. It's a kind of a field where without interaction or without, you can't design in isolation. So what are the different factors that will expose you to become a better designer, which is, I think, which lacked in my undergrad, which I also, because now I've worked in design, so maybe it's a personal thing that I like to be more collaborative, or I like to work with people rather than, you know, in my own cocoon, because I know that you'll get better results when you're talking to people about things and when you're solving a problem where people are involved.
Yeah. I did this project over a summer a few years ago, which was based in New Delhi. And the project was about, well, mostly researching on the accessibility that wheelchair users have when accessing public buses. Mm-hmm. And IIT Delhi has an ID department, and They're really great. Like, I love the dean. He's Dr. PVM Rao. He's super cool. He's been in the he's been in disability design for like decades now. But IIT had this like hackathon or whatever, like design hackathon, and like a lot of schools came together and they were designing. And Dr. Rao told me to like go check it out, and I did. And there were like these students from different from another school, not IIT, but they had this design for like a soundless horn for cars. All right. So it's like you're sitting inside the car, and then the car would know something that they added in the car, like a chip or a computer processor or whatever. But when you press the horn, there is no sound, but the cars next to you would know that you're honking, some sort of like a beeping or like a light or whatever. So that, you know, to reduce noise pollution, that was the thing. Now, but then, you know, so I was walking around and I was talking to them, and I was asking them questions about it, just being annoying, you know. they're trying to get this done, and I'm like, hey, what did you talk to people if they want this? And they were like, not really, you know. So there's no start, for the most part, though. That's like in a lot of places, not just that particular school, but. Yeah, people tend to start with the design. And that's, I think, like a human thing to start with, like, hey, I should make this. And then the error is to not kind of rationalize that. Like, yeah.
Yeah. You have to start with the problem, or just if the now the problem could also be two ways. There could be an existing problem that you want to attempt to solve through design, or a problem that doesn't exist but you find from research. So again, I think that's why, I mean, it's so important to just have back up your projects or your work with research and with people. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm trying to do now. I mean, in terms of the kind of projects I'm looking to do with in my master's, which is also different from furniture design, because, I mean, let's face it, with furniture design, I'm not solving a problem per se. I'm designing furniture, and what we're trying to do is bridge the gap and really find a language for Indian furniture design. That was our aim. But now, the whole idea for me to do my master's after starting the business and being in design for a bit was to maybe pivot and see what else there is for me to do. What are the things that interest me? What do I want to learn? Because again, as a creative, there's no boundary, right? I don't just want to be a furniture designer. Maybe I want to be lots of other things. So just being able to explore that.
Is that why you took the leap to, like, you know, you had a business, you have a business that's been running for 7 years. Is that why you came to RISD? Like explore? Yeah.
Absolutely. It was, I think, just the quest to know what my potential is. And the fact that, like I said, I was born in Delhi, went to school, did my graduation, worked in Delhi. So I've literally been in one city all my life. So it was also the opportunity for me to get out, explore, expose myself to the offerings of the design world in the West. Lots of factors, actually.
What are you liking at RISD right now? Like, what's the move right now? Because this seems like sort of like a self-discovery or like an expansion of your capabilities in order to test yourself. And RISD is a test, or any design school, if you do a master, it's a test. How is it pushing you? Where are you taking this?
I think when we initially started talking, I mentioned that you have to forget what you've done, because you're here to start something new and really explore your true potential or enhance yourself and identify your space in design. So that's exactly what I'm trying to do. I think consciously I'm not doing furniture design projects here, just because that's something I've done before. I enjoy it. I absolutely love making furniture, but I wanted to hold that and try to explore new things. And I guess one of my agendas, or just my goal, was to look at larger humanitarian problems, maybe, and through the medium of ID, which can be many things, attempt to solve or like touch upon and explore all of those directions. Hopefully, like, what I'm enjoying here is that this is something I hadn't done in the last 10 years since I started like studying design or got into the field of design. So that's exciting. Exploring different things, exploring climate through the lens of gender inequalities, just the many, many layers of the crisis, and how can I contribute to finding solutions on the way? So that
I'm like kicking the mic all over. Get into what you said. That's very interesting. What is that? Get into that. The climate in through the lens of gender inequalities. What are you thinking about?
So this was, I mean, how it started was with my studio project in the first semester, when we were starting to work on like more discursive, speculative design. And
yes,
I knew I wanted to work in like sustainability and something in the climate change, in this realm of climate change largely. So my research actually started with, like, my first thought bubble was, okay, climate change. I'm going to solve climate change.
Yeah.
And then this other thought bubble was just crime. And I for some reason, I was looking at these very, like, intense topics. And when I started kind of moving forward with both my independent thought bubbles, I also saw that there was kind of a congruence to both, and how different crimes were exacerbated by climate change. And one of them happened to be gender-based violence. So when, with the change in climate, with displacement, with people losing jobs, losing their homes, how are women still suffering violence because of their gender? And even how they're, I mean, kind of an at-risk population, and specifically looking at women or people of the global south. So that's kind of what sparked this first set of research, kind of sparked the dialogue. And then I did a lot of research on the topic. And there's a lot of data by the UN, by the UNEP, and even the International Union for Conservation of Nature, things like that. I mean, all of these big trusted sources which claim that climate does impact genders and different populations differently. Mm-hmm. So, and through the lens of speculation, I kind of actually gamified these realities or this research into a project called Entitled, which was okay. My first studio project. And mm-hmm. I mean, of course, I can talk about that later, talk about that more, but it's a little difficult to explain it without actually showing you how the game moves or functions. But it basically is a two-person game, and kind of inspired by how you would play like a game of snakes and ladders. So there's a dice and there's a board, and you kind of move, you're supposed to kind of from start to finish, reach the end. And as you progress on the grid or the board, there are certain prompts or action cards. And then those action cards are based on the facts that came out of my research. So simple things like how some women are not taught how to swim or to climb trees. So at the time of risk, if there is a flood situation, they're more often than not just stuck or stranded because they're not trained to do certain things which the men in the family were trained to do. Or even things like how women were still kind of looked at because their clothes were drenched in like flood water.
Rain, flood, yeah.
Yeah, so all of those things, and just taking those prompts, I designed the game. And
so it was more based on like bringing about awareness, or yes. Were you trying to like, the thing with like speculative design is you're trying to get this reaction, or?
Absolutely. It was a provocation, I think. Mm. Because what I did with the game was, and even when I presented it with the class, the idea was that I made two of my classmates play the game. Then they played the game, and without context, I didn't explain, okay, this is what's going to happen in the game. You're just here to play a game. And then the person who won was asked to just kind of express how they felt. And the person who lost was again asked, okay, how did you feel? You lost the game, whatever. And for them at the time, they were just playing a game. But that happened. And then I got the first set of responses from the winning team and the team that lost. And then I basically had this audio set, which then kind of narrates what actually happened in the game. And then there was another set of questions. Okay, now you know what the game is about. Do your reactions flip? And that was, I think, the most interesting part of that experience, mm-hmm. that the person who won realizes that they won because they had the opportunities or they had everything going in their favor. And the person who lost was the other gender, which doesn't get those opportunities or had to face many other difficulties in even like winning that game. So I guess those two reactions were important, and those two reactions kind of marked the success of the project, at least for me, that they did get provoked. It was like a moment of, oh shit, is this what happened with the game?
So yeah, and this is on your website, right? Vrindamathur.com.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And it's, yeah.
Yeah, I have this. I pulled up this like article by the World Economic Forum, Why Climate Change Increases Gender Inequality. Climate change is putting an increasing burden on women as a direct result of extreme weather events. Women face the threat of sexual violence in displacement camps and extra labor and childcare duties. The findings come from a new report by CARE International. The report concluded that women are far more likely to suffer the consequences of climate change than men, from sexual violence in displacement camps to extra farm work and greater risk of illness. Women should shoulder a bigger burden from worsening extreme weather and other climate pressures, pushing people to move for survival, according to Global Aid Group. This is crazy.
Yeah, and I mean,
where are the men going? What do you mean extra farm burden? Like, what are the men doing because of the floods?
What happens in a lot of cases is that the men are working in the big cities. So the
women, okay,
and the older parents are left behind in those destinations, which are more at risk. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the reason is that. And I mean, there are other consequences also, like in India, especially like child marriage, how the family would have the daughter married at an early age because mm-hmm. they would just have one less mouth to feed. So, and I mean, again, it is multi-layered: climate change, conflict, poverty, hunger, just everything clubbed together.
Yeah.
But we kind of have to acknowledge that the climate is changing. And there are many, many different consequences to it. I picked this one sliver for one of my projects, but there's so much more. I mean, what I've done for this one, this project is a very small, I mean, it's a student project. We'll see where it goes. But I guess that's the kind of work I see myself doing and hope to just, even like raising awareness is important. With speculation, I myself, sometimes I'm like, I love the idea of discursive design and speculating futures and things like that. And I do think it has the potential to bring about a change. But then I'm kind of sometimes conflicted that what is the call to action? I've done all of this. Now what next? What can this audience do? Or another thought I had for this particular project was that, can I maybe take this game to an NGO or other facilitators working in the same space, and can it be used to actually educate the women about these disparities or about the things that are happening to them, which might not come so naturally to them, because in a lot of cases they just, or largely we just assume that, oh, it's normal, you know. So how to change that perception is also important.
Yeah, like it's definitely a hard problem to solve, because it's systemic, and it's there are various, not just one, there are various systems of oppression in place, especially for women in the rural parts of India. And so like, are there solutions? I think CARE International is working on something, but like, in your research, did you come across like what can be done? Because it seems like such a difficult issue, because they have a home there, they have a family, they have kids.
I think just giving more power to women, like if it means that they need to be trained towards something, if it means that even if it means self-defense or being involved in understanding climate change or because women, I think 80% of these, or 90% if I'm not wrong, are actually farmers, women farmers. And again, mm-hmm. we don't make that connection that, oh, a woman can also be a farmer, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
So can you give them the voice to actually, because they're working in that space, to actually identify climate change? What can we do about it? How can I safeguard myself, my land, my family, instead of them waiting for their knight in shining armor who will come and save them? So it's about giving them that power and that agency that you can fight anything yourself. So it has to be, I mean, it has to do with education, it has to do with awareness, and just empowerment. And there are many, many great organizations that are doing it, but I guess at a smaller scale, and maybe just identifying or amplifying as much as
you can. Yeah, like the sad part is, like, it's going to take, like, yes, education is the most important pillar, or like the piece in the puzzle that's the solution for all of this, and that'll take time, and not only the women but also the men need to be educated, right? Because they think that, you know, urbanization is the solution, then going to like urban spaces and then working and sending money back is enough, but it's really not enough, you know. It's enough to sustain the family, but that's not like the livelihood.
Yeah.
But also another issue is that a lot of these families, like growing up, my family was heavily involved in the tea garden business. So a lot of the summers I used to spend in tea gardens and going around with my uncle, and a lot of the tea pickers were women. And the thing with tea picking is that it's seasonal. And so an entire part of the year, they don't have a job. So they have like different places that they go to. So that also like kind of displaces their security in a way. Yeah, it's like a whole bunch of things.
It's like you said, it's a systemic problem, and it can take many, many years to reach that phase of, okay, now there is no longer this problem, but any kind of violence against women has been happening for ages, and we haven't found a solution.
Yeah.
So it's right.
Yeah. Are you going to, is that project's over for the semester, but then do you plan on taking it forward after, maybe?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that project closed, I think, in December, but this summer I'm actually doing the RISD Maharam Fellowship, which basically gives RISD students an opportunity to work in the social impact sector.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. So I hope I can kind of take a part of this project forward through that. I will be working with the Delhi government, their Department for Women and Child Safety. And my idea was to, again, Delhi is a city. It's an urban environment. And how can I maybe look at disaster risk management? And again, pull out the women and young girls to be the voice of this movement. So kind of an extension to the project, and I'm still figuring out what exactly it's going to look like, but hopefully I'll get to actually be with an audience and interact, like I said, not do it in isolation, but actually speak with people who can give more feedback and make it more real.
Do you think that this journey of yours is going to affect Studio Wood positively or negatively or anything like that?
This has been kind of difficult for me to figure out, because like I said, Studio Wood runs as a design practice with an ethos which is embedded in design of objects. Mm-hmm. But even in that space, we're constantly, and that's why I spoke about collaboration. It's not just about, you know, making beautiful products and selling them. It's also the relationship we have with our makers, and how we're constantly, like, through our different collections, trying to use more craft, and also that we are 100% handcrafted unit. So kind of keep working on that, that part with Studio Wood. And even with Studio Wood, we have, because where our studio is located in New Delhi is in an urban village. So even there, we've tried to do like smaller projects within the community, just to kind of introduce them to ourselves and have more of a dialogue. So I guess somewhere in this is consistent in terms of, okay, not just design, but what are the other, what is more meaningful even as a practice or as a studio where we want to be. They do run as different practices. I mean, what I'm doing now and what Studio Wood does originally, but we're constantly like seeking ways to make it a studio that is, like I said, like embedded in community.
Yeah. I think a lot of what the block print industry, the resurgence of block printing has done for Rajasthan and Jaipur and all of those artisans over there, I think there's potential even with carpentry and furniture making to, like, I don't know, involve, I guess you're doing your part as well in like growing towards that, and you're, to a certain extent, you've already like involved the community in your business. But yeah, I think, but then do you feel, how do you handle like the, I know as a business, you're like not in line with mass manufacturers. Like there are furniture companies and stores in India that are huge, you know? But I know through pricing and through positioning, you can differentiate yourselves, but, and if it's handmade, then a lot of the time it's not mass manufacturing. It's like special to order and stuff like that. Yeah. But do you, yeah, but like, do you, the mass manufacturing is, I think, do you think it's problematic or do you think it's fine?
Okay. I'm just going to give my opinion because that's what we're doing here, right? I don't think it's problematic per se, but it's just not our space. The scale that we work with, or the kind of the team size that we work in. But problematic in terms of, yes, the supply chains. I want to know who made the piece, where the wood came from, what polish you're using, what wages were paid, all of those things. I mean, and increasingly, I feel like the audience is becoming more and more aware of the story of their products. And that's why there is a demand in small businesses. There is a growing demand because of that authenticity or that storytelling, which is hopefully not just brainwashing. Mm-hmm. So it's okay if you're mass manufacturing, but as long as everybody is getting due credit, and it is a clean process, I think that's what's important.
Yeah.
The other thing, of course, is that when you're buying something from a designer or a smaller studio, you also get that it's a unique piece. Whereas anything you buy from the larger corps or big box stores, I mean, almost everybody has that chair behind you in the background. Yes. So things like that, but that's fine. I mean, it's a super comfortable chair.
It's an amazing chair. Yeah, it's an amazing chair. But that's the thing. Like, I think it isn't problematic. If you conduct a business in a certain way, for example, my friend Joyce Chang, she did a project. It was her thesis, but a part of it was like a nutrition label style mm-hmm. of that makes you aware or tells you about how much of the thing that you're using is recycled. And this was mostly for tech objects. And so, you know, nowadays Apple makes you buy little things for even like to stick your USB in. And it's a lot of like waste material. So the project was around like having a nutrition label that, a nutrition label style to tell you like, okay, this has a percentage of recycled steel, a percentage of recycled silicon, something like that. And I think maybe not like on the products or anything, I don't know, I'm just like spitballing here, but maybe even with furniture, it's important to know if the wood is sustainable to the local region, or if the polish is toxic, or like what are you stuffing the cushions with, and all of those things are very important, right? And I think if you're doing that on a mass scale, it's what you achieve is accessibility. Like a lot of people cannot access expensive furniture, which might be sustainable and helping the community, but they don't have the economic means. And then they go out and buy shit furniture that harms the environment. But I think there's an opportunity for mass manufacturing in a sustainable way that can like,
And that's what will help your business. That's what will help the environment in the long run. So I won't say recently, but I've always kind of been mindful of what I'm purchasing and how is it going back? Like how circular or not is the product? And it's very difficult to do it at the size of the studio that we are, because if I'm just making one, like let's say in a year, hypothetically, I made 10 chairs. Now, for those 10 chairs, each and those 10 chairs over 12 months. So every time, and we don't have the capacity to make things and keep stock and buy stock and things like that. So it is difficult to manage all of those things as a small scale company. But just even understanding things like, okay, if I'm making something within one sheet of board or one sheet of veneer, then how can I optimally use that one sheet of veneer without producing waste? Mm-hmm. If, you know, whatever those tiny slivers are left over, what can I do with that potentially? And even with paints, yes, just moving from like doing a dew coat paint or doing a powder coating to doing a water-based paint, lot of new technologies are coming in, but at a price. And the moment we use that technology, our cost price goes up, our selling price goes up. Is the audience ready for it or not? So again, comes back to that, just the question of awareness, that maybe a more environmentally sound or educated or one who understands the system would probably pay that extra buck. Versus somebody who's just like, oh, you're selling a table for 20,000. I'm not going to buy it. Mm-hmm. So there are all kinds of audience, and I don't want to be in a space where I have to justify why I'm charging what I'm charging. It should be very transparent, and that quality, that design, that making comes at a cost. And who is willing to pay that price and who isn't? And again, I mean, that also is debatable, because people who are like importing furniture from like Germany or China or whatever, why can't you find a good Indian manufacturer who is doing their own designs and you can buy it from them for like half the price? What is this fascination with, you know? So that was another like gap we're trying to mend by actually designing pieces, which are one of its kind, which you will not find on any other website, and take it home and be happy with it.
Yeah, there you go. Stop buying from Vitra, buy local. So like, what's the future for Studio Wood? Have you thought about it? Are you still pondering? Like, because 2 out of 3 of the co-founders are here now in the US. So what's going to happen? Are you being able to manage it from here?
Yes, of course. I mean, I guess that's what we kind of identify, that we are going to work with the current collection we have, and we're just going to shuffle that in the market. But it is difficult. It's not, I mean, just the time difference is like so much that you're often like confused, okay, whether things are going to happen, not happen, whether that call is going to get rescheduled. So of course those little hitches keep coming in the way. But I guess this also gives us an opportunity, a studio word, to talk about ourselves here in the US in a new country, potentially look at having our pieces displayed or sold here. So I guess it definitely opens more doors for the studio as well.
Yeah, it's definitely a good opportunity, but then also there's this slippery slope that you might have to navigate, which is, again, you know, selling it. But yeah, which I think you might be able to do it, but then you have to see where you're sourcing that, because then again it comes to like, why should the US market export their furniture, not buy locally? Then I think it's an exciting challenge and it's an exciting future to like look at maybe local manufacturing here or something like that. But I'm sure you guys will be able to figure it out. It's exciting.